I mean, school in and of itself feels completely different. Like, I don't even really process or experience. I don't think of it as school.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and its affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison.
Why did it take a pandemic to see how extraordinary this job is? Why did it take a pandemic to see that we needed resources?
Today, we bring you the first of a two-part series on how the pandemic is impacting the struggle for a culturally affirming, socially just, and liberating educational system.
There's never been a moment when we've needed a closer connection, a humanized relationship between teachers and students than now.
We begin by looking at how public education during today's pandemic reflects a battle that has already been raging for more than 500 years. The fight over education didn't start with Donald Trump or COVID-19. Competing values and visions have been clashing since European settlers first invaded the lands of this continent's indigenous peoples and tried to impose their educational system. Indigenous worldviews and learning processes have always offered a stark contrast to colonial and corporatized education. Here's Dr. Leroy Littlebear, Professor Emeritus at the University of Lethbridge and a founding member of Canada's first Native American Studies Department.
Europeans, for a long time, had this formal education and so forth for quite a few centuries, and to a large extent, the educated, for instance, was the church. And they brought this over almost in a missionary sense. Let's see if we can educate and proselytize, brainwash the younger people. Mm-hmm. And that's why the prohibition of native languages came into existence and so on. The formal education system came into existence as a way of brainwashing the younger generation. And to a large extent, that's still going on. Except today, there is now a large number of Native Americans that are realizing that, hey, this system of education is not working. There's nothing in it that I can relate to because it's not talking about my history, my culture, my knowledge, and so on. Education is basically the handing down of the collective knowledge of a particular society to the youth, to the newborn, to the younger generation. And this is done so that the younger people, when they grow up, will end up carrying on the traditions, the customs, the beliefs, and so on. In the Western view is that the teacher is the holder of the knowledge, and the students just open their minds up, and the teacher pours it all in. Whereas in the Native approach, it's really about lived experience. There's a deference given to what is normally referred to as elders, because they've lived long and they've had a whole bunch of experiences. And when they're teaching, they never come down and say, this is the way it is. What they'll always tell you is, this is how I've experienced this. And they'll tell you the story. In other words, the elders kind of would get younger people and the young children and so forth, and they would tell them stories. And in each of these stories, relate to them the meaning and the lessons behind each of those stories. Mm-hmm. So that would, if you want to say that, that's, that is institutional, yeah, that would probably be the closest, and so on, in terms of a formal type education. But a large part of it is also mentoring. Mm-hmm. The older people, the grandmas, the grandpas, and uncles, older people, relatives, and so on, would take younger people with them, whether one by one or as a group, and say, hey, let's go out and hunt. But in the process, it's not just running the deer down. It's not just running the game down. But they learn about all the topography of the land, the plants, and so on. What is it that these animals like to eat? And so forth. This is where they're going to hang out and so forth. Mm-hmm. They learn all about that in the process of hunting. So it's by actual lived experience. It's by actual doing. So when we're talking about education, it begins to say that Westerners approach education, for instance, from a non-renewal basis. So in other words, if you're in grade one and, you've done grade one, okay, now we're in grade three, let's say, and then you forget how to do a particular math problem or, something, what does your teacher say to you? The teacher says to you, oh, you should have known that. We taught you that. You were taught back that particular problem and how to do it in grade two, in grade one. See? Mm-hmm. In other words, been there, done, did it.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Because it's fixed.
Whereas in native thought, coming back to the notion of renewal, knowledge has to be renewed all the time. It's like love. That's one aspect of the public education system. It's been on the approaches, hey, been there, done, did it, let's move on.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Native people's approach would be, hey, we have to renew this. We have to tell the stories over again. We have to do the same ceremony. That's why, we do the same ceremonies year in and year out. We tell the same stories. We sing the same songs. That's part of renewal. See, and that's non-existent or almost non-existent in the present education system.
The U.S. public education system was transformed over the centuries as the country expanded through settler colonialism, slavery, industrialization, and empire. But at every step, those who had wealth, power, and privilege had a very different educational experience from those who did not. Dr. Kevin Kumashiro, former dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco, reflects on this history.
What we see in the late 1800s, early 1900s was a major shift because at this time in this nation, we were going through our own industrial revolution. And coinciding with industrialization was the growth of large cities. So industrialization went hand in hand with urbanization, which also went hand in hand with immigration. Large groups of people were immigrating from particularly European nations at the same time that we were building these larger and larger cities. So all of a sudden now, we were at this place where we were asking ourselves, well, how do we kind of control this large population, many of them newcomers to this country? And so it's not surprising that this was the time when we saw large public urban systems begin to develop, particularly in metropolitan areas in this country. And what's interesting is that the schools that we developed now for the masses looked really quite different than the schools that we were developing a century earlier for the more elite. The schools for the masses began to really mirror a lot of the elements that we saw in factories. So we began to divide students much more. We divided them by age. We divided them by, in many times, gender. And we also began to compartmentalize the work that they were doing, just as we see in factories. So we began to divide by subjects and divide by time and so on. And it's also the case that the curriculum became less about kind of thinking and reading and writing and expression and creativity. It became much more about rote memorization, much more a curriculum that really taught you to follow rather than taught you to lead. And this is the beginning of public education, right? So we could say, yes, public education began for the most elite. And as we were forced to integrate more and more people, we came up with more and more ways to sort students. I like to make the argument that although we often say the purpose of education is around helping everyone to succeed, leveling the playing field, equal educational opportunity, the function of schools has always been to sort and differentiate. We just came up with more and more indirect ways to accomplish that.
It seems to me that in the school this ebony, African history should be pumped up steadily, but it's not. And this has got to stop. See spot, run, run, get a spot. Insulting to a black mentality, a black way of life or a jet black family. So I include with one concern that you must learn.
In the 1950s through 70s, the struggles of oppressed peoples for civil rights, human rights, and self-determination challenged centuries of educational injustice. Some fought for equal access to the educational system, while others created new models like freedom schools that directly linked education to liberation and social justice. Dr. Fanny Rushing, a history and global studies professor at Benedictine College, was field secretary for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in the early 1960s.
A small group of us pioneered in creating the first residential freedom school that SNCC had, and we had that here in Chicago. The idea was to bring together young people from the South and young people from the North for liberation. It was not ever a matter of simply learning one's ABCs or mathematics. It was very much a question of how do we use education to liberate ourselves? What do we need to know to bring about the kind of society that we want? And of course, based on SNCC's philosophy that every single individual has the ability to understand his or her own life circumstances and to make changes in the direction that they want to make them was at the very root of the learning process. The big thing once after Brown versus the Board of Education, this question of equal access to education through integration of the schools and through busing. And it was really just a question of equal access, that people had a right to go to school, but not a concern so much about curriculum until the middle or latter part of the 60s. One of the things that moved to the forefront was to begin to dismiss questions of integration and to focus exclusively on curriculum and culture so that the schools were basically set up to be Afrocentric. Primarily, the objective was to root the student in a cultural milieu that was conducive to reinforcing a positive image of the self. In all of the Afrocentric schools, in the nationalist schools, it was very much this question that one has a positive image of the self, everything else will fall into place.
Believe that if you're teaching history, deal with straight up facts, no mystery. Teach the student what needs to be taught, because black and white kids both take shorts. When one doesn't know about the other one's culture, ignorance swoops down like a vulture, because you don't know that you ain't just a janitor. No one told you about Benjamin Banneker, a brilliant black man that invented the almanac. Can't you see what KRS is coming at? Well, Eli Whitney, Haile Selassie, Granville Woods made the walkie-talkie, Louis Latimer improved on Edison, Charles Drew did a lot for medicine, Garrett Morgan made the traffic light.
but you won't know this if you watch show. The point I'm getting at, it might be hard, is we're just walking around brainwashed. See what I'm saying? It's not to diss a man. We need the 89 school system, one that caters to a black return, because you must learn.
Since the 1980s, wealthy and powerful interests have promoted a neoliberal agenda for corporatized education that has continued into this century. They've gotten bipartisan support and massive funding from billionaires and their foundations, including the Gates, Walton, and Broad foundations. The major pillars of this corporate education agenda include standardization, privatization, and attacks on teachers' unions. Dr. Diane Ravitch was the Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush, and she was appointed by the Clinton administration to oversee federal testing. Today, Dr. Ravitch is a professor at New York University and one of the most prominent critics of the corporate-driven education policy she helped to create.
Children learn at different rates. They grow at different rates. And yet Common Core makes these demands based on the expectation that everyone can learn in a lockstep way. And if only you set the standards high enough, everyone will achieve them. But there's no evidence for that. At bottom, these claims are baseless. Firstly, because the standardized tests just aren't that good. If you want to predict test scores, the single most reliable predictor would be family income and family education. Actually, family income matters even more than race at this point. And I quote the research by Sean Reardon at Stanford, and he's an economist who found that the racial achievement gap was not nearly as large as the income achievement gap. So if you want the single most reliable predictor of low test scores, it would be family income. And then when you add into that not just poverty but segregation, it's what in my book I call it a toxic mix. And wherever there is high levels of segregation and high levels of poverty, you will find low test scores. This occurs at a time where I believe we're facing a national teacher shortage because so many teachers are leaving. They're discouraged. They feel demeaned and disrespected by the public discourse. But teacher tenure means that teachers have the right to due process. It means nothing more than that the teacher can't be fired without just cause. And that's only fair because sometimes people are fired because they earn too much. And the principal would rather have two young teachers than one senior teacher. I think that if tenure were abolished, we will see parts of this country in which teachers won't dare to teach evolution, in which they won't dare to teach any of the books on the American Library Association's list of the most censored books. I mean, even the Harry Potter books are banned in some districts.
In the first two decades of the 21st century, social justice educators, unions, and grassroots organizations fought the corporatizers by mobilizing students, parents, and communities for educational equity and new models of social justice education. Next, Dr. Bill Ayers, a retired professor of education at the University of Illinois in Chicago, and his brother, Dr. Rick Ayers, an education professor at the University of San Francisco, challenge today's dominant educational paradigms.
It's not just enough to ask questions, but you have to be willing to be honest about what you see right in front of you, because the kids see it, and they know that the grown-up world is a bunch of hypocrites. If I'm teaching in this system, and I go along with it, and I don't ever raise a question or a critique or ask the students to question things, aren't I complicit in the system, just as teachers 150 years ago, many of them must have been complicit in taking slavery as just common sense, just the way things are. What are you going to do?
Social justice on one level is something that's in the heart of the educational project. Nobody goes into teaching saying, I'm really looking forward to furthering the achievement gap, or I really want to send a lot of kids down to the suspension room. People go into teaching saying, I want success for all students. So everyone has an idea of social justice. What we're struggling to unpack then is, how does that work?
We have to always ask, education for what purpose? Of course, we all want our kids to grow up to live full, complete, happy, purposeful lives. We want them to be able to love other people. We want them to be able to work and produce and contribute to society. But I think we have to say right from the start that if we aspire to educate free people, there's a certain requirement that goes with that, and that is that we don't want to teach either explicitly or implicitly that the highest value you can aspire to is obedience and conformity. We want to teach kids the values of initiative and courage and creativity and imagination, because free people require those kinds of qualities more than they require obedience or rule following. Being a good citizen involves being able to think critically about everything that's presented to you and being willing to engage with others in questioning the status quo, wondering about what's just and fair and decent, and then making the kind of moves that one has to make in order to contribute to this kind of society that we would like to live in.
Even the term teaching is problematic. It's a transitive verb. It suggests that I am handing something to you. I teach you. I possess something that you don't have, and I'm handing it over. Once you're in the classroom, you realize that that's a really inadequate term, that we are doing something together, again, a human, messy, complicated enterprise. And a teacher, if I have to use the word, is only good if she constantly questions her own authority and constantly challenges the given dogma of what a body of knowledge is. So the development of knowledge is a constantly evolving thing.
We're not done. We're not done. We're not done. Check this out.
And now along comes COVID, creating unimaginable challenges and mind-blowing opportunities for the future of public education. On the one side, the corporatists are implementing the shock doctrine, using the pandemic to more aggressively impose neoliberal education policies. At the same time, millions of minds are opening to the possibilities of a more equitable and liberating educational system as the pandemic exposes systemic white and male supremacy and the failures of capitalism. The interviews you just heard were excerpted by Polina Vasilyev from a 15-part series called The Battle for Public Education in the 21st Century, produced by Pacifica's Ken Yale. You can hear the full version archived at t4sj.org. That's t4sj.org.
My coronavirus hits me so hard. All the teachers say, oh my Lord, COVID is stressing me. All the updates from the CDC, Lysol can't be found. I've looked all around this town. I've had no luck. And these are the things, huh, you can't touch. I told you, students,
you can't touch this.
You better pull that mask up.
You can't touch this.
It's the CDC, not me.
You can't touch this.
Hey, go wash your hands.
You can't touch this.
Fresh new rules and plans. Let's all be safe. Go wash your hands. So move back up 6 feet. You better not cough and you better not sneeze. Sanitation. Hold on, let me check your temp. Not under your arm, like that. Like that. You're all clear, go to the back. Everybody says that this is too much, and these are the things, huh, you can't touch. 6 feet.
You are listening to COVID Race and Democracy.
Stop, sanitize.
When we think about teaching and learning during the pandemic, the first thing that comes to mind for many people is online education. A team of scholars from the California Alliance of Researchers for Equity in Education recently published a research brief about online education. Dr. Carol Batker, an English professor at the University of San Francisco, is one of the authors. She had this conversation with COVID Race and Democracy producer Ken Yale.
The for-profit sector has really structured and shaped what we've come to understand as online education. And the idea is this: that online education is a product, and that product can somehow produce a livelier, a better education than in-person learning. This is the corporate narrative. The six studies that we took a look at and foregrounded in the brief really definitively show that in-person learning is far more successful than online learning. One study of online and blended and hybrid education in K-12 looked at 35 different states, and it showed that online education in all of these formats produced graduation rates at roughly half the state averages of graduation rates for in-person learning. We know from a lot of congressional investigation and a lot of studies that were done that even in higher ed, for-profit online education has been a miserable failure. I think one of the things that's most important for your audience to understand is that education is far more complex than the corporate online education models address. When online education is delivered, it's often a kind of a factory model that's put in place. And so what you get are larger class sizes, you get curriculum that isn't designed or developed by people who are experts in pedagogy, and you get people who are less experienced as teachers or prepared as scholars delivering that education. So it's no wonder that you get poorer scores, you know, in terms of learning outcomes. Right now during COVID, because of the enormity of the disparities in access to broadband internet, to hardware like computers or iPads or tablets, we often think that to have access to education or to eliminate disparity, that what we need is this kind of education as a product. We need to buy more stuff. We need to put more stuff in the hands of students. What we really need is actually more of a priority placed on the relationship between the teacher and the student. And what that means are lower class sizes. What we mean by that is the ability for teachers who are well paid, who have been fully prepared, who have an expertise in pedagogy as well as in the subject matter, who can differentiate for students who have different learning needs, how to deliver appropriate, equitable, just curricula, and who can adapt that curricula as they teach. I'd like to tell you a little bit of a story about my own teaching during COVID to kind of highlight the difference between this corporate model and what really constitutes education. I had only 23 students, and I'm teaching at the college level. Most of my students are from California. And in addition to the pandemic, my students were grappling with wildfires and smoke and power outages and evacuations. There were some students who had really good broadband, who had great headphones, who knew what they were doing in terms of their technology and had a great computer. There were other students who lived in areas that did not have good power. One student, in fact, her power went out 5 times with the wildfires. So she actually spent several classes in her car on her phone down the road where she could get cell service, but then she ran out of data and she couldn't afford any more data. And then I had a student who was an English language learner, and you know, it was just harder for her to hear and understand what was happening. I had students who were evacuated and would just disappear for a while. There were some students who had a room or an office and it was quiet and I could hear them and they could hear me. There were other students whose family were behind them making noise and talking and crossing the screen throughout the class. So clearly they didn't have the same ability to afford a private space. People whose family members were ill, and so they were out of class trying to care for or just worried about family members. So what this meant for me as a teacher is that there was a lot of disparity in terms of how much information any one student was getting. I couldn't assume that they were all going to be in class, that they were all going to have the information that I was presenting. So I did a lot of tutorial. If I had had a class of 100, there would have been students who wouldn't have gotten anything from the class. So in this COVID context, online education is far more complex and difficult than even in a regular online education distanced teaching circumstance. One of the worries is that administrations will think that the way students are going to be educated, we just need to find those for-profit companies that have some kind of courseware. We need to buy hardware for students. But even when students have great hardware, that's not access to education. Access to education has to do with their ability to be taught by highly qualified teachers and professors who have a small enough class size so that we can actually determine what the students' needs are. And one of the things that we recommend in our brief that I think is very powerful is that funding should be supporting community schooling models, because even if we handed out all this technology, what we really might need are not only teaching staff, but social workers and psychologists and school nurses and nutritionists, people who can reach out and find out what students really need to support a context in which they can then have direct access to a teacher and begin to learn again.
Another musical number. It's a tricky time for teachers at the moment, as we know, with many transitioning to online learning. But one music teacher has summed up how most of them are feeling with this impressive song.
Hey, so as some of you guys might know, I'm a music teacher, and I found that one of the best ways that I can process the whole transition to online learning and teaching is to write a song. So I wrote a song. I'd like to share that with you guys now. Here we go.
Next up, student producers Travis Baldwin, Gabriel Cromie, and June McNally share reflections on how the pandemic is impacting students at Berkeley High School in the San Francisco Bay Area of California.
I mean, school in and of itself feels completely different. Like, I don't even really process or experience. I don't think of it as school. I mean, I think it is a lot harder for me to enjoy what I'm doing without the added social aspect, because I think that, like, there was always this motivation to go to school to, like, be with people and have a good day, even if, like, academics wise, I wasn't really enjoying what I was learning. But now it's almost like it's just really depressing to look at everybody through the screen. And it's really hard to comprehend that those are real people and these are people in my, like, quote unquote classes. That whole aspect has just been completely stripped, and it really, like, feels isolating.
I feel like dying every couple months. Spent this past year falling in and out of lust. Honestly, I wish that was love, but it ain't no one.
Is balancing school life and music easier now?
I would definitely say yeah, but because before the quarantine, I didn't really have like time to record in my everyday life. But like now, I'm always at the house. So like I can record a verse or like a hook in between classes, or like make a beat during class, which is kind of irresponsible. So don't do that, kids. But like, yeah, sometimes I just zone out and then like make beats and stuff like that in class.
At the beginning of the pandemic, you started putting tally marks on your wall. Walk me through why you started and if you're still going.
I started because I thought it would be funny, you know, like a cartoon, jail cell kind of thing, where they do that thing. And I didn't think that coronavirus would last that long. So I thought it would be a kind of a cool thing to just have on my wall. But now I stopped doing it around 70 days. So I stopped doing it mainly just because I was really struggling to do simple tasks during lockdown, especially before summer started, before I started seeing my friends, just spending a lot of time by myself. I had a really hard time getting out of bed and stuff. And one day it just stopped.
Would you say that was like kind of a pivotal moment when you stopped?
I mean, I really stopped thinking about hoping to return to school soon or any of that stuff.
I wasn't able to appreciate a lot of the benefits of school in person that you get because of primarily my anxiety, but other factors as well. So I found that when I was going to school less, that was easy. When I was, you know, doing more work at home and such, it was easier. So then when all of the work that I had to do, I could do at home, that was pretty much easier for me. There are other ways in which online school would be more difficult, but I would say that in general, it's easier, and I appreciate the sort of change that it's given me.
So when it first locked down, I was like a completely different person. I mean, I think I just had no clue what to expect. And everybody, when like lockdown first happened, everybody thought it was just going to be like maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month at most. And so I didn't really think it was a super big deal. And I mean, yeah, I kind of liked the break. I liked being able to just like be at home. And then I think as the weeks went on and it got longer and longer and longer, I started to realize like, oh, this is like a real thing.
Never know how someone truly feels behind the screen. I don't wish you well because you're not with me. I know it's petty, but that's how I really be. I ain't doing no more verses for free. You want me now?
Hi, I'm June McNally, and for this episode of COVID, Race, and Democracy, I'm going to be answering some questions and talking about my experience of school during the pandemic. So the first question is, how has your experience of school changed since the pandemic? The first thing that comes to mind is the reduced amount of motivation I have to learn. Like, the goal isn't really learning all I can, it's more about getting all of it done in time I can. I'm a freshman in high school, and I was really excited to start school in the new year of 2020, and doing all the work online just really took all that excitement away. Like I said before, I just started high school, so it's hard to determine if this lack of motivation is from COVID or high school because it's all so new. Then there's this, like, whole spectrum of our social lives. Mine has changed greatly. At school, you kind of have a couple different friends you hang out with in each class, like your friend from Spanish or your friend from physics, and then you have the friends you actually hang out with at lunch and after school. But on Zoom, it's really difficult to connect with anybody during class or make new friends, and that's when you kind of rely on social media or rely on the friends that you used to make an effort to hang out with by FaceTiming them all the time. But one of my closest friends actually DM'd me after we were in a breakout room on Zoom, so it's not hopeless to make friends over Zoom, it's just a lot more difficult to do online. So the second question is, how does your experience of education in the pandemic compare to students whose backgrounds are different than yours? Some examples are race, gender, class. I've actually thought about this before. In terms of how class affects my education, I have to say I'm very privileged. I and the majority of my peers have the tools and supplies that we need for school, like computers and textbooks, etc., and I know I'm really lucky to have that. People that can't afford proper online school supplies are at a huge disadvantage, and it's really detrimental to their education overall. Thinking about how race affects kids' education during COVID is, again, hard for me to tell because I'm in a place of privilege there. Historically, people of color, especially Black people, have been oppressed in terms of education, and many people of color have lesser opportunities because of it. Therefore, I think race would affect the whole class system, affecting the supplies and tools and resources you have for online school. So it's kind of like this whole cycle. And people that are oppressed, usually even in real life school, would still be getting that same type of oppression online.
You've been listening to excerpts from student productions by Travis Baldwin, Gabriel Cromie, and June McNally, with support from WBAI producer Marcos Maldonado. To link to their full productions, go to the webpage for this COVID, Race, and Democracy episode at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Now we'll hear again from Dr. Carol Batker in conversation with Pacifica producer Ken Yale.
Can you say a little more about how those inequities are playing out at the K-12 level? How might special ed students be impacted or homeless students? What are we seeing in terms of how online instruction is impacting and exacerbating inequity?
I want to make sure that your audience understands the difference between the kinds of inequities that have to do with access to technology and inequity that has to do with access to education. Even when there is an equitable distribution of, you know, hardware and internet, there can still be disparity in learning outcomes based on how resourced schools are, how many teachers, how big the class sizes, you know, how many kids are in the household, are there parents at home who are available to do asynchronous work or homework, are there parents who are well-versed in technology, does the community have supports, does the school have supports for families who, even if they have a tablet, may or may not be able to help their students work through technological means to access education. There was a study in a high poverty district in LA that showed that there was a 20% point difference between white and Asian American students and Black and Latinx students' access to education. Also, that study showed that English language learners were also participating at a rate something like 20% lower than English proficient speakers. The disparities in online education around students who have disabilities, that's been a long and deep issue for online education.
It's very important to have specialists who understand the variety of disabilities and the kind of teaching that can actually occur in a distanced environment. We know that for students with disabilities, it's been very difficult for them to get the services that they needed during COVID. So there have been court cases that have been filed about the failure of public schools to serve students with disabilities in Hawaii and New York and Pennsylvania.
So to what extent do you think students should be returning to the classroom at this point, given the health and safety dangers? And what would it actually take? What kind of resources and what kind of investments would we need to make in order to make it safe to open up schools and classrooms at this point in the pandemic?
We are not advocating that schools should open because of this dramatic difference in the effectiveness of in-person education as opposed to online education, because first and foremost, we want our students and we want the teachers, we want the faculty to be safe and healthy. And so that we leave to science and to public health experts. I think they should be making the decisions around when it's safe for students and teachers to come together. But regardless of that, both at the federal and state and local levels, we need better funding. We need it now, whether students are in the classroom or not. There's never been a moment when we've needed a closer connection, a humanized relationship between teachers and students than now.
If the research is so clear that online instruction is not as effective, that it does exacerbate inequities both in access to technology and in access to education, who is it that is pushing that agenda? Who is profiting from it financially?
In terms of who's profiting, Zoom, for example, which so many higher education and K-12 schools ended up using, they expect to triple their profits this year. In August, Apple became the first corporation valued at $2 trillion. And there's also another issue because there are all kinds of protections, state and federal protections for student privacy when you have data being collected at a school site. But when people are working on Facebook and Google Classrooms and Zoom and through learning platforms like Blackboard or Canvas, for-profit companies are collecting that data. And so even if you don't consider other issues that happen online, like bullying and sexual exploitation, those kinds of things, there's just the opportunity for student data to be exploited, demographics, data, information in a way that we've just never seen before. It is important to note canned curriculum coming from companies that might be billing themselves as experts in online education. First of all, it's really important to scrutinize that research behind any kind of curriculum or product that's from a for-profit entity. And it's also really important to make sure that curriculum is being developed that is culturally, linguistically, and socioeconomically appropriate for diverse learners. And that's not generally what you get when you're getting a canned curriculum, right? I think that's another concern. What's going to happen to the curriculum in this moment when teachers are overworked and have too many students and are maybe reaching out to rely on these canned materials that may not be academically and culturally sound? I think what's not often seen is that there are huge companies like Pearson, actually many in the large corporate publishing arena, that have partnered with public colleges and universities, community colleges, have partnered with nonprofit private colleges and universities, and have really structured the way they think about online education. In terms of higher education, we're getting more and more people on boards of trustees who are working in financial industries and who are venture capitalists who have a vested interest in some of these money-making propositions, which is what for-profit online education is all about. It's about generating profit. It's not really about educating students, or certainly doesn't see education as a human right. So we have a lot of work to do. I honestly think that the COVID crisis has brought to light the problems with online education that have been there since really its inception, but haven't been seen or taken seriously enough. So I think the good news is now that we have so many teachers who have been thrown into this frying pan, I think we're going to be much more able to articulate what's wrong with this idea that education is a product. Federal and state funding needs to support public schooling and teacher salaries, and we need to lower those class sizes. Don't bleed public education money by spending it in for-profit corporate settings, whether that be Zoom or Apple or Pearson. Stop that outflow, that draining of our public monies into the for-profit sector, and instead invest in education as a human right and in a powerful set of teachers, well-paid, supported, and a whole network of providers for community schooling.
That was University of San Francisco Professor Dr. Carol Batker. You can find her full research brief about online education at care-ed.org. That's care-ed.org.
There's a reason for this. There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. It's never going to get any better. Don't look for it. Be happy with what you got. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. They're irrelevant. The politicians are put there to give you the idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. They've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, the city halls. They got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies, so they control just about all of the news and information you get to hear. They got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table and figure out how badly they're getting by a system that threw them overboard 30 years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly your jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this place. It's a big club and you ain't in it.
That was iconic comedian George Carlin. Next up, get ready to shake up your thinking by connecting the dots between the prison and educational systems. Dr. Bettina Love is a professor at the University of Georgia and co-founder of the Abolitionist Teaching Network. Musical accompaniment by Dead Prez.
Why haven't you learned anything?
Man, our school is a joke. The same people who control the school system control the prison system and the whole social system ever since slavery. Know what I'm saying?
It's not a radical thing to want to be seen as fully human. It's not a radical thing to want to say this, the way y'all set this up isn't fair. The way you set it up, some people get to play, some people don't get to play. The way you set it up, not only do we not get to play, there are now structures and institutions and conditions that make sure that I can't play and my children's children can't play. And so when we think about education and its link to abolition, it has so much to do with the ideas that folks like Angela Davis have given us. Folks like Ruth Wilson Gilmore has given us. David Stallbowl, Erica Minor. Let me not forget Charlene Carruthers out of Chicago. And what they have said is that we not only want to abolish these buildings. That's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to abolish the conditions that create those buildings, yes, that make it possible to suspend and to lock our babies up. The conditions that make it possible to standardize tests to a point where I don't even know what grade I'm in anymore. The conditions that make it possible that we're not hiring Black and brown teachers. So abolitionist teaching is so much about eradicating and not trying to reform, because what we know so much about reforms is to appease white folks. For the white liberals to feel like we're doing good work. We got a reform in. So while you're doing good work and while you're doing these little gradual reforms, I'm dying. We're doing away with the idea that schools cannot have kids play. We're doing away with standardized testing. We're doing away where our babies don't learn their history and their culture and the beauty of who they are, right? And those things that we're asking is human things. It's things for humanity. It's things to be seen and to see yourself as beautiful. That's what abolitionist teaching is about. And so it may seem like a big lift, but it's a lift for humanity, for all of us. Mm-hmm. And if you don't see that in our little Black babies, then you can't be an abolitionist.
I went to school with some redneck crackers. Right around the time Third Base dropped the Cactus album, but I was reading Malcolm. I changed my name in 89, cleaning parts of my brain like a baby nine. I took a history class serious, front row, every day of the week, third period. Had calling them racists. I try to show them crackers some light, they couldn't face it. I got my diploma from a school called Rickers, full of teenage mothers and drug dealing niggas in the hallways. The popo was always present, searching through niggas' possessions, looking for dope and weapons. Get your lessons.
I was floored at how, when we shut down schools, how so much became possible. So we shut down schools, and in a matter of a month, we're done with standardized testing. Really? We've been fighting for that for decades, and now you're done with standardized testing? Okay, cool. You know what? Every kid get a laptop to go home. But just last week, those laptops, you couldn't take them out. I mean, they were like precious gold. Oh, you know what? Teachers, we need you. We're gonna rely on your pedagogy and your ingenuity and your creativity during this time. Oh, so now we're a profession again. Parents, you're the number one thing we need right now. Oh, we need parents. Oh, tech companies giving out free internet. Oh, you can give out free internet? Why did it take a pandemic to see the humanity in teaching? Why did it take a pandemic to see how extraordinary this job is? Why did it take a pandemic to see that we needed resources? Why did it take a pandemic for them to say, well, you know, because of the pandemic, the gaps are going to be exacerbated? No I think the pandemic has shown us a hand that they were willing to play in crisis that they were never willing to play before. And now we have to say that we're not going back. The managing of inequalities, we're not going back. And we have to be clear about that as educators. That's what abolition is about. To say that what you thought was normal, that was not normal. Expelling kids, killing kids. I mean, we haven't had a school shooting. Ooh. And that got to a point where it was normal to report on school shootings. It was normal to talk about Black and brown children being expelled. It was normal to have police snatching and hurting and body slamming young girls in classrooms. That became normal. And we have to say enough is enough. So we have to now take this moment, and when we do reopen schools, to say that same energy, that same creativity, that same ingenuity, that same trust that you gave parents, that same trust that you gave teachers, we want it back.
That concludes part one of COVID Race and Democracy's education series. In part two, we'll dive deeper into the impacts of COVID on public education and how other nations are educating students during the pandemic. Today's show was produced by Polina Vasiliev and Ken Yale, with contributions from Rick Ayers, Travis Baldwin, Gabriel Cromie, Phil Halpern, Marcus Maldonado, and June McNally. Artistic contributions were from Boogie Down Productions, George Carlin, Dead Prez, Quentin Lee, and an anonymous music teacher. The executive producers of COVID, Race, and Democracy are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Seltzer. Learn more and get involved through our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.